Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect's Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2001 with a Millennium Grant from the Scarman Trust. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com/dialect. This week, a special looking at the Israel lobby. They call him a Holocaust denier. But if you have the time to look into it, you'll find that's because he said the Nazi Holocaust of the Jews wasn't the only one. He cites the previous Holocaust by the Spanish, the French and the British of Native Americans, which killed an estimated 100 million in North and South America. The fact is, the accusation of Holocaust denier against Israeli-born jazz saxophonist Gilad Atzmon is simply used to shut him up, and it's a classic smear by the Israel lobby. So tonight, Israeli musician Gilad Atzmon, he's author of The Wandering Who, and also another book, Being in Time, which looks at human rights, Israel and Palestine, identity politics, Islamophobia, anti-Semitism, and political correctness. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk and based at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft on Jamaica Street. I'll give you our contact details at the end of the show.
My name is Gilad Atzmon. I'm a jazz artist, and I'm also a writer. I write about Jewish identity politics in general. I analyze the situation in Palestine, not from a political perspective, but from a cultural and ideological and even metaphysical perspectives. I argue that if Israel defines itself as a Jewish state, the one thing that we should do first is trying to understand the difference between Jews, the people, Judaism, the religion, Jewishness, the culture, the ideology, to understand how those issues relate to each other and how those issues or these notions define what Israel is. It defines its politics, its expansionist ideology, and to a certain extent, when it comes to the massacres that we see in the last few months in Palestine, where they deploy snipers against unarmed protesters, this is all outcome of, I believe, rather than policies, it is the outcome of a certain ideology, certain culture. It is the outcome of what the Jews call themselves chosenness, which is a form of racial supremacy. Now, when it comes to chosenness, this helps us to understand the situation in Palestine. At a certain stage, in the late 19th century, some Jews were slightly concerned with assimilation. They believed that assimilation can lead to the evaporation of the Jewish people as they knew them or as they knew the Jewish identity. Those people who were lately defined as early Zionists at large accepted the anti-Semitic argument. They accepted that Jews were slightly different. They accepted that Jews had, I'm not saying what I think now, I'm referring to early Zionists, they accepted the Jews had a detrimental effect on their host nations because they were not as productive as the people around them. They didn't go to work in factories and were peasants. There were a lot of reasons why this was the case. And they believe that it's not the Jews are fundamentally different. It all happened to Jews because they were removed from their alleged promised land. And this is the moment of birth of the Zionist idea. They decided that once they return to their so-called promised land, all of it is going to change. They will turn into productive people. They will work in factories. They will work on the land. They will be peasants and so on and so on. And the truth of the matter is that all of that worked for a few weeks. They went to Palestine. They formed all these collective agriculture settings known to us as kibbutzim. They started to work in factories. Doctors became carpenters and bricklayers. And within a short while, they realized that the Palestinians were by far cheaper, and this was the beginning of the end of the Zionist dream. Now, I'll go back to myself. I was born in Israel in 63, many years before I realized that Israel was actually Palestine.
Gilad, you know, you're talking about them, but you are Jewish yourself, aren't you? I mean, you were born there.
Exactly. This is exactly where I'm. you just told me when I'm talking about my Jewish past. So as I said, I was born in 63 in Israel, and as I mentioned, quite a few years before I realized that Israel was Palestine, and I myself was raised to believe in this dream of new Hebrews. This is exactly what you want me to discuss. I believe that we can be different. I believe that we, the Israelis, the so-called Sabras, the people who were born, the native Israelis, I believe that we were different, that we could defend ourselves unlike our diaspora cousins who, according to the Zionist narrative, went like lamb to the slaughter. I believed in work. I believed that work is liberation. My father was an hardcore worker. You know, he worked in a factory. He, you know, left the house at dawn and came back in the early evening. And to a certain extent, and you'll probably find it surprising, I definitely don't see myself as a Jew anymore. I departed from Jewishness many years ago, more than two decades ago. But I can say that there are some elements in this early Zionist ideology, what some people may call Israeliness, that are still very significant for me, and they're probably integrated into my beingness. So I definitely would like to see myself as a Jew. I'm an ex-Jew, but there are more than a few elements of what some people may define as Israeliness. It's part of it is the my assertiveness and my ability to say things as I see them. And by the way, I also get little trouble from Israel. The people who really are desperate to stop me are some element within diaspora Jewry, and particularly within a left Jewish diaspora. It is quite pathetic, but pretty much the entire list of the people who were my arch detractors in the last 10 or 15 years are now expelled and suspended from the Labour Party from being so-called anti-Semites.
But look, let's get back to actually talking about what's going on in Gaza, because you've got two countries in one. Can you just explain what's happened there? Is it just simply a racial split, or is it a religious split? It's a very difficult thing, I think, for many people to understand how what Benjamin Netanyahu and his government are doing relates to things like the Old Testament, the Torah, the Talmud.
Okay, so it's a very interesting question. And it can be tackled from, again, many different perspectives. To start with, we have to understand what is Gaza. In 1948, we see a huge expulsion of Palestinians from their homes, from their cities, from their villages, from their land, from their orchards. This expulsion is racially driven. It's basically an ethnic cleansing. And it is called the Nakba. If people are not familiar with this term, now they know what it is. Many of those Palestinian refugees end up in Gaza, not only in Gaza, in many other refugee camps in Lebanon. As we probably remember from the 80s, Sabra and Shatila, but many others, in Hilwe, Yarmouk in Syria, Burj al Barajneh again in Lebanon, many Palestinians in Syria, in Jordan, and other Middle Eastern countries. Many Palestinians ended up in the West, in Britain, in America, in France, and so on and so on. The Palestinian that were expelled in 48 couldn't come to their back to their land because the Israeli law of return discriminates the Palestinians on a racial basis. So if you are racially Jewish, you can immigrate to Israel and you become a citizen on the spot, on the moment of your arrival. And we are talking about people who have zero connection to this land, never been in this land before. The Palestinians who have been dwelling on this land for generations cannot return to their own houses, to their own homes, to their own land. Now, an important clarification. I myself don't believe the Jews are a race. I don't believe that there is a racial continuum between an Ashkenazi Jew from Poland and a Yemenite Jew from Aden. However, Jewish politics is always racially oriented. So we are looking here at the difference between being a race and identifying oneself as a race. It's a very important distinction. And for that matter. The Palestinians are definitely not part of that race, which is, by the way, important to mention, it is more than likely that the only true Jews are in fact the Palestinians, and there are some historical text that deal with this issue, but I don't want to get involved in this topic unless you ask me later.
Now, look, so what I'm asking you about, though, particularly, is how what Netanyahu does, his policies and his party and his government's policies, relates to the biblical scripture, the Old Testament, the Torah, the Talmud.
Of course, of course. You see, in order to tackle such a question, and it is a very important question, you have to produce some background. Now, your question is very important, especially because Netanyahu doesn't look exactly like an Orthodox Jew. We don't see him with a skull cap. Many members of his government and his Likud party are not religious. In fact, his government is quite hostile to those Orthodox Jews who refuse to serve in the army. So what is happening here? In order to understand it, we have to accept the Jewish, and this is why I concentrate on the J word rather than the Z word, Zionism, Jewish identity and Jewish identification are very unique notions. So, for instance, if you are a Jew and you decide that you don't believe in God, you're still more than welcome to consider yourself as a Jew. As we know, most of the Jews that we know around us, for sure, are secular, and they still identify as Jews. If you are a Muslim, and this is very different, and you decide that you don't believe in God, you stop being a Muslim. If you are Catholic, not believing in God, don't go to the church, you stop being Catholic. You remain British. If you are Muslim and you don't believe in God, you're not Muslim. You are Pakistani or British or Palestinian. Jews somehow sustain their Jewish identity while not adhering to any Judaic religious concept. And here is the revelation. The notion of Jewishness is way more crucial than Judaism. We have to ask, what is it the Jews sustain even when they drop God? And this is the concept of chosenness. There is a very interesting development that happened in early Zionism when Herzl is trying to negotiate. Herzl, the most significant Zionist forefather, the inventor of this idea. He finds himself negotiating with different superpowers about the possibility of having a land for the Jews, a Jewish national home. And Herzl himself was quite open to many ideas like Uganda and so on and so on. And he brings this idea to the First Zionist Congress, and the reaction is very strict. They say, are you mad? They say, no, we want Palestine. He said, why do you want Palestine? They say, because this is our promised land. He said, according to who? They say, according to God. But he says, you are not religious. And the answer is, we are not religious, but it's not the exactly the religion. This is what our identity is all about. So we can understand already then, in the first days of the Zionist project, that the notion of Zionism, the notion of the Jew within the Zionist context, is slightly more complicated than a strict religious belief. Now, when it comes to Benjamin Netanyahu, and to a certain extent also his foes within the Labour, their transformation of the Judaic thought is very clear. What they really did, they replaced the Talmud with the Old Testament. What do I mean by that? Judaism, the religion, Orthodox Judaism, is an adherence to the Talmud. The Talmud is very similar to the Sharia in Islam. It's a book of laws. To be a Jew is to follow laws. Those laws are defined by the Talmud. Zionism splits the Jew from the Talmud, and it makes the Torah, the Old Testament, into the Zionist prime religious text. And this is why Israel becomes the promised land. The promised land becomes the highlight of the Zionist project. While promised land wasn't at all an issue for Orthodox Jews all along their diaspora, and we are talking about something like 1900 years. And by the way, for Orthodox Jews, Israel is still not the promised land.
Okay, so we've got a situation where the majority of the Zionists, and particularly the Likud party, these people who are governing Israel, have decided that they're really not interested. They're more secular than biblical Jews, but they still want to retain this, the idea of chosenness, which you said. But if they're chosen, who are they chosen by, if not by God?
Definitely. Listen, I'm not defending this idea. I'm not trying to say that it is rational. But I will tell you something that is slightly embarrassing. Who is the Jewish God? The Jewish God is a pretty problematic character when you think about it, yeah? When you look at the Old Testament, it's not the most ethical creature around. And you ask yourself, how can people believe in such a God? How can people believe in a God who calls them to invade another people's land, and take their wells and take their land, and all the quotes are for us in Deuteronomy? And my answer is that it is actually the Jews who invented God that somehow managed to choose them over all other people. So it is the Jews who determine the nature of God rather than God that determine the nature of the Jews. And this is why the Jews are very flexible with their God. When they don't like their God after Auschwitz, they drop him. Or heir, you know, now the Jewish feminist rabbis think that God is heir. You know, he's a female, you know. And they drop him. And in fact, I argue that Judaism is just one Jewish religion amongst many. At a certain stage, communism was the new Jewish religion, and Marx, became the Messiah. And after a while, it was enlightened egotism, and Ayn Rand became the Messiah. And at a certain stage, moral interventionalism became more interventionism, I should say, actually. It became the new god, the neocon god, sorry. And so on and so on. And I came to realize that Jewish religion is a very flexible concept that facilitate chosenness. So if you are a Jew and you want to become a Bolshevik, it is totally fine because you are chosen. You believe yourself to be better than anyone else because you argue that everyone is equal. Obviously, it's an absurd, yeah? And neoconservatism can make you feel chosen because you believe in moral interventionism. You do it, you do all of that. You know, you're killing other people in the name of human rights and so on, basically Coca-Cola. So I think that we are dealing with a very flexible identity that can take many shapes. And if people want to understand what it is, they have to accept that the concept that they are studying is shifting as they try to understand it.
Well, what about Israel's role in anti-Semitism? You did a post about that recently. Anti-Semitism has been in the news here in the UK for months, and yeah, a lot of people pointing at the Labour Party as being infested by people who are basically Nazis. So in what way do you think that Israel has got a role in actually creating anti-Semitism?
Many people, including myself, have been writing about it for many years. I think that I started to write about it 20 years ago. As things happen, we are dealing with a catastrophic, vicious circle. The actions taken by Israel clearly lead to anti-Jewish feelings. So when people see Israel deploying snipers and drones and airplanes against unarmed civilians, protesters, and killing them and injuring them on thousands, people are very upset. And since Israel defines itself as the Jewish state, some people are very upset with the Jews. Such developments make or can make Jews very insecure. What do? They consider making Aliyah, immigrating to Israel. And this is the cycle. The more brutal Israel is, the more Jews seek shelter in Israel, which is exactly the fundamental demand of the Zionist agenda, to make Israel into the home of the Jews. Now, the outcome is pretty devastating because, as we know, a lot of French Jews and British Jews and diaspora Jews in general have secured themselves a Holocaust shelter in Israel, in Tel Aviv, in Jerusalem. These houses are basically standing there vacant. And the meaning of it is that Israelis, Jewish Israelis, cannot really find a roof in their own land. So they go, you know, they serve in the army, they commit all those atrocious crimes against humanity in the name of a vague concept, securing a home for diaspora Jews who don't even think practically of moving to Israel. They just keep it as a safe haven. And this instability in Israel came to the fore in 2011-2012. We saw quite a lot of unrest in Israel. As we know, the gap in Israel between rich and poor is, if not the worst in the Western world, is pretty much at the bottom. It is very interesting. But to answer your question, Israel definitely contribute to the rise of anti-Semitism. The devastating outcome is that Israel, bizarrely enough, benefits from such a rise.
What about Ken Livingstone? He's a senior politician here in the UK. He's a former mayor of London twice. He was even made the mayor of London, even though the Labour Party had kicked him out. They decided to eject him. He's now been voluntarily, he's left after being suspended for a comment that Hitler supported Zionism. Now, he's been misquoted saying Hitler was a Zionist. His actual comment was that Hitler supported Zionism. Now, going back to 1933 and looking at what was going on in Nazi Germany, it did seem that some sort of deal was being done between the Zionists and the Nazis in order to get rid of the Jews in Nazi Germany and send them over to Palestine, if that was possible. Yeah. So what would you make of Ken's comment that Hitler supported Zionism? Do you think that's justified?
Ken Livingstone was telling the absolute truth. There was an Avara agreement, or in English, transfer agreement, that was signed in 1933 between the National Socialist regime in Germany and the Zionist institutions that were operating in Palestine. There was no Israel yet. And thanks to this agreement, I think that more than 60,000 Jews from Germany and Austria managed to make Aliyah or immigrate to Palestine, and by doing so, probably saved their life. So there were some inaccurate details in Livingstone's statement, but you know, for instance, he spoke about Israel, and it was actually Palestine at the time. But his statement is 100% right. Now, the fact that such a hero, a political hero, an anti-racist, brings, and it is devastating what I'm saying, disrepute on a party in Britain by telling the truth means that Britain has removed itself from the liberal, enlightened ethos. It's not a free country anymore. It's a tyranny of correctness that is defined by Jewish sensitivities. But there is a further question. Why are Jews allegedly offended by someone looking into their past, or even more precisely, telling the truth about their past. What is it about the Avara agreement, the transfer agreement, that is so painful for Jews to admit? This is the question that we have to ask. And if the Jews cannot admit to themselves that there was such an agreement, why can Livingstone or the Labour Party have to pay the price? And I think that my definition of Jewish power produces an adequate answer. I argue that Jewish power is the power to silence criticism of Jewish power. Ken Livingstone was critical of something that can be realized as Jewish politics in the early 30s. What do we do with him? Jewish power. We silence him. The same power is implemented or employed against the Labour Party, because it is very clear that some Zionist bodies really don't like Jeremy Corbyn. I think that a fundamental advantage of a free society is the ability to call a spade a spade. Now, I'm doing it, but I can definitely see that less and less people can afford to do it, because calling a spade, talking, for instance, about a clear historical fact that is approved by every Jewish history text, there was a Avara agreement, 60,000 Jews, more than 60,000 Jews, German Jews, Austrian Jews, were saved by this Avara agreement. The fact that we cannot really address these issues in Britain suggests to us that Britain nowadays is not the Britain you were raised in or the Britain I immigrated to. It changed into a very problematic state, and I really hope that Brits can turn it around, but I'm not so sure that this is the case.
Now, what is it, do you think, about the Zionist movement, and particularly the current Likud government, that finds this Havara agreement? What is it about it that they are, it seems, afraid of, or what is it that's so problematic?
I don't think that anyone in Israel is afraid of the Havara agreement. Israel, as you probably remember, received quite a lot of money and still receiving a lot of submarines, and I don't know if a lot, but enough submarines and support from the German government. So Israel doesn't have an issue with the Avara agreement. Israel attempt to conceal the Nakba. This is what concerns them. The people who are upset by the Avara agreement are diaspora Zionist organizations, and this is part of their battle with Jewish so-called anti-Zionists. So the Jewish anti-Zionists use Avara agreement in order to point out that there was something intrinsically sick in the Zionist project even before the Nakba, all right? So you look at these Zionist Jews. They were negotiating with Hitler, and they managed to strike a deal. So it's an internal Jewish debate between the so-called Zionist Jews and the anti-Zionist Zionists, who are, in my opinion, as disgusting as their Zionist foes. For me, every person who operates politically, not religiously, politically as a Jew is fundamentally a racist. Because assuming that you, Tony, are not a Jew, you won't be able to become the chairman of Jewish Voice for Labor. You know why? Because you are not racially qualified. You, Tony, won't be able to become to run as a candidate for the chairman of the Jewish Voice for Peace. You won't be able to do it because, unfortunately, you are not racially qualified. So basically, for me, the anti-Zionist Jews are at least as racially oriented as their Zionist foes. And I'm embarrassed to admit to you and to your listeners that in Israel, the third biggest party in the parliament is an Arabic Palestinian party. This is way more goyim, Gentiles, than we see in the Jewish Voice for Labor or Jewish Voice for Peace. Okay? So, in fact, Israel attempts to deal with Jewish racism. As you probably know, Haaretz paper, and I don't like Haaretz, but I would give them that, they're way more liberal and open to criticism of Israel and Jewish culture and Jewish identity than the Guardian of Judea.
You mean the London Guardian?
The London Guardian, our Guardian. We call them the Guardian of Judea.
I just wanted to ask you finally about Roger Waters, and because you're both musicians. Can you tell us, are you in touch with him? And what is it about musicians that seems to be one of the strongest and most articulate voices for the Palestinians? Because it doesn't seem like there are many political voices, certainly in the Western world, speaking out for the Palestinians. We had a early day motion in the Houses of Parliament the other week, which had only something like 15 signed it after the massacre in Gaza. And there were more people who signed the early day motion congratulating hedgehogs than there were that signed that one. So what is it about you musicians that gets, I suppose, you engaged with this issue where our politicians, who really should be doing this stuff, don't?
Okay, so to start with to your question, as you probably know, I am the last saxophonist featured on Pink Floyd album, but Roger Waters is not in the Pink, part of the Pink Floyd for many years. So actually, I worked with the David Gilmour section. I've never met Roger Waters, but I obviously am fully aware of his activity, and I think that he's doing a lot, and bless him for it. And now to address your question, I think that it is not that complicated. The philosophical answer is that while politicians are operating within a given recognized language game, we artists are there to bring along a new language game. We artists are there to reshape the future and ideally present a prospect of a better future. A better future that entails peace, harmony, reconciliation, and so on and so on. But it goes farther. When it comes to music, when it comes to art, you just cannot lie. I cannot write a bad tune and convince you or force you to like it. I have to write a piece of melody that genuinely makes you cry or jolly or optimistic. This is the biggest power of aesthetics. This is the biggest power of music, especially music, because we are really dealing with an abstract language. This proximity to truthfulness makes musicians at large into people who can deliver the truth about Palestine. Now, let's make sure that everybody knows supporting Palestine can cost you your career. The music business worldwide is at large dominated by Jewish businessmen. Not only, but they are definitely by far overrepresented, especially in America. And they're very forceful, and they are mounting huge pressures, they're mounting huge pressure on artists that express their views. I think that even Roger Waters, despite his strengths, could feel it in the last year when they tried to pull out some of his concerts, and we are talking about arenas. I've seen some concerts of mine being cancelled in the past. It didn't happen for a while now, but we are dealing with a very powerful lobby. They managed to expel thousands of people from a thousand labor members. We can imagine that they succeed in pulling one jazz gig a year or there. However, I think that Roger Waters is very dedicated to this cause, because he was there, he was in Palestine, he saw what is involved with it, and it touched his heart. I'm doing it, I'm not an activist, I'm doing it because I'm fascinated by issues to do with Jewishness, ideologically, culturally. I can see how dominant Jewish culture is. In my recent book, Being in Time, I speak about the dominance of Jerusalem over Athens, and the way I differentiate between the two. Athens is the birthplace of philosophy, of truthfulness. Jerusalem is the birthplace of obedience, litigation, rules, correctness. We are living in a Jerusalemite tyranny of correctness. The question that we have to ask ourselves is, what is it about Jerusalem that is so dominant, that its survival ability is seemingly stronger than Athens? And how do we bring Athens back? And I think that in terms of bringing Athens back, Roger Waters is a great force. He's not the only one. I see myself as a dedicated advocate of Athenian thinking, And I do want to believe that the Brits will find their way back to Athens, and the same applies to Americans, French, Germans. That's it.
Okay. Righto, thank you. Oh, do you want to just finish off? Just give us your website.
Yeah, my website is gilad.co.uk. My recent book is called Being in Time, a Post-Political Manifesto. My last album is a tribute to John Coltrane. It is called The Spirit of Train. This is what I'm doing these days. I'm touring around the world and talk about my ideas and play my music.
Gilad, thank you.
Thank you.
That's all for this week. Dialects Bristol's first weekly podcast. You can download it to listen on your phone or in the car. Subscribe and listen the week before broadcast if you like at dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guest this week, that's Gilad Atzmon, the Israeli musician, author of The Wandering Who and Being in Time, two books about human rights, Israel-Palestine, identity politics, Islamophobia, anti-Semitism, and political correctness. Also thanks to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialects, a Bristol Broadband Co-op production, catches on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us at the People's Republic of Stokescroft, just off Jamaica Street. They're online at prsc.org.uk. You can talk to the PRSC office on 0117 909 6897 or the famous China Shop on 944 4540. Volunteer with us if you like, or for hundreds of opportunities across Britain on the National Volunteering website. That's do-it.org. That was Dialect. And I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Be back on Friday with my two-hour BCFM politics show, live from 6 till 8 p.m. In the meantime, thanks for listening to Dialect. Until the same time next week, goodbye for now.